You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on August 16th, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, I interview Ambassador Nicholas Burns on the Iran nuclear deal. Then, co-hosts Nate and Kelly join me to catch up on the Republican presidential field and Planned Parenthood. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. The following interview was recorded on Friday, August 14th, 2015, for arsenalfordemocracy.com and 91.3 FM WVUD in Newark, Delaware. My guest this week is Ambassador Nicholas Burns. He served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008, and he has negotiated for the United States on nuclear deals with India and Iran. On Iran, he served as the lead U.S. negotiator until early 2008. He is speaking out in support of the Iran nuclear deal now being considered in Congress and around the world. Ambassador Burns, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you very much.
So let's get into the details of this deal. First thing I think on most people's minds, what does Iran give up and what are the enforcement mechanisms that are in place to ensure that this deal does what it's supposed to do?
Well, Iran gives up the right to have a nuclear weapon, and it gives up the capacity to build one for the next 10 to 15 years. So specifically, Iran, over the last 10 years, since 2005, has been driving towards a nuclear weapon. It's built up both its plutonium and uranium facilities. Under this agreement, Iran's program will be effectively frozen for the next 10 to 15 years, so it won't be able to produce the highly enriched uranium, the fissile material, to produce a nuclear weapon. That's number one, and that's the most important thing that Iran gives up. Secondly, Iran will be subjected to inspections on its nuclear supply chain for the next 25 years. Third, it will be put under very intensive verification and monitoring by the United Nations, by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I think those are substantial compromises by the government of Iran. Right now, the Obama administration calculates that Iran is about 2 to 3 months away from having a nuclear capability. With this agreement, Iran will be knocked back on the continuum and be about a year away. So those are substantial concessions by the Iranians, and I think substantial gains for the U.S.
You mentioned about nuclear supply chain and plutonium. It seems to me there's some confusion in the public regarding kind of the nuclear science aspects involved in the deal, and I think that's something that our nuclear physicist, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, worked very hard on by all accounts. What are the scientific factors here that prevent Iran from working on a nuclear weapons development, you know, over the next 10 to 15 years or immediately nuclearizing after 10 or 15 years?
Well, I am definitely not a nuclear physicist. I'm a former diplomat, and now I teach at Harvard University, so I can't give you the physics behind it. Secretary Ernest Moniz can do that, and he's done so quite effectively. But it's what I just said. The two routes to a nuclear weapon are through uranium enrichment or plutonium processing. The agreement that President Obama has negotiated will shut down both of those avenues for the next 10 or 15 years. Now, those are the benefits of the deal, but there are risks, and the risks are that 10 to 15 years from now, these restrictions that I just enumerated begin to lapse under the terms of the agreement. Iran could reconstitute a civil nuclear program, for electricity production, but the danger is that at that time, Iran could use a civil nuclear program as a cover for covert activities, for secret programs. So we're going to have to be watching very carefully the United States, other countries, and the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I think the real critical time would come not in the next presidency, but with the successor of President Obama's successor sometime 10 to 15 to 20 years from now.
And it's not like Iran could just build a smaller bomb or something like that because we've taken away some of their plutonium or they've given up some of it, right? Because that's something that I've sometimes heard people suggesting. Well, okay, they wouldn't be able to make a big one, but you know, maybe they could make a small one. Is that realistic?
It's not realistic. It would be extraordinarily difficult for Iran to produce a nuclear weapon over the next 10 to 15 years because the restrictions that the U.S. is imposing on them are so severe. And it's very likely that we would see any attempt to divert from the agreement by Iran. So I think what your listeners can presume is that whether you agree with the deal or disagree with it, we're going to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear weapons country for the next 10 or 15 years. Now, what we gave up, of course, this was a compromise. What the Obama administration, the U.S. Negotiated was that these restrictions will be taken off Iran 10 to 15 years from now. And so that's where two presidencies from now, our American president will have to be very tough-minded. And if Iran makes any attempt to become a nuclear weapons power, we'd have the option, obviously, of using military force to prevent that from happening. We'll be much stronger than Iran at that point. And we have the option of reimposing an international sanctions regime on the Iranians. So it's not as if we'll be without alternatives should the Iranians try to become a nuclear weapons country two decades from now.
There's been a lot of discussion of how this affects various U.S. allies. Some U.S. allies, particularly in Europe, seem pretty strongly in favor of the deal. Other allies elsewhere are a little bit more concerned. Specifically, I wanted to touch on the Persian Gulf allies. It seems like previously those governments, including Saudi Arabia, had expressed serious concern about the possibility of Iran getting nuclear weapons, but now they're saying that they fear the implications of the deal and claim that this is a bad outcome. Is this deal really a legitimate concern for them, or is it more kind of posturing and general antipathy toward Iran?
Well, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries have been natural antagonists with Iran for centuries. They're rivals for power in the Middle East. They are friends of the United States. And when Secretary John Kerry was in Qatar a couple of weeks ago, the Qatari foreign minister speaking on behalf of all of these Gulf Cooperation Council countries, so Kuwait, the UAE, Bahrain, Oman, Saudi Arabia, he said that they actually supported the nuclear deal. There's certainly unhappiness in many parts of the Gulf, but the governments have come around to say they support it. Most governments around the world are supporting this. Of course, all the European countries are, Russia and China, Japan, India, South Korea. The one country that is adamantly opposed, of course, is Israel, and the United States and Israel have a profound disagreement over this the nuclear deal.
That sort of brings up a question of Iran specifically. Trust is a concept that's been coming up a lot, and obviously the Israelis do not trust Iran at all. We are skeptical, but not necessarily quite as firm on that point. It seems to me that Iran comes in for sort of special negative treatment in the U.S. media a lot of times. Is there any particular reason to think that Iran in 2015 uniquely could not be trusted in a way that wouldn't be true for other governments that we have difficulties with, but we, you know, have various agreements with?
Well, there is no reason why the United States government should trust Iran right now, because Iran has lied about its nuclear program consistently in the past. And of course, Iran is also the major funder of many of the terrorist groups that are shooting at the Americans and the Israelis and the moderate Arabs. And Iran is also making right now a major push for power in the Sunni world. If you look at Iranian actions to support the Assad regime in Syria, it's supporting the Houthi rebels in Yemen, it's supporting the Shia militant groups in Iraq, and it's supporting Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. So Iran's a real problem. Iran has to earn the trust of the United States. It hasn't done so. I don't think it will for a long time. So I think one of the points that President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry have been making is this deal, the nuclear deal, is not built on trust. It's built on verification, meaning the International Atomic Energy Agency and countries like the United States are going to be watching Iran carefully to make sure that they meet their commitments, because they haven't been consistent in doing that in the past.
Now, you said just a moment ago that you don't think that anytime soon there's going to be much reason for the U.S. to trust Iran, and that this would require a long process. But one thing that I was thinking of, and this is a show that is geared particularly toward younger audiences, it seems like, you know, there's a new generation, right, in Iran, in the U.S. Iran's a particularly young country demographically. But in the U.S., obviously, I think a lot of the people, still older folks, remember the embassy hostages. And but we've got, you know, in the U.S. there's a post embassy generation, there's a, in Iran there's a post Khomeini generation. Is this deal at all an opportunity to maybe reset relations and potentially seek at least an opening down the line for closer strategic relations with Iran?
Well, you're right to suggest that part of what may now happen is you may see a lot more interaction between the Iranian and American peoples, students going back and forth, tourists going back and forth. And for the first time in 35 years, the U.S. and Iranian governments are now at least talking to each other. And I think that's a breakthrough. We don't have to like the Iranian government to have an interest in talking to them, because it does help us if we're able to transmit very clearly what U.S. views are, and if we're able to get a sense of what the Iranians are trying to do. Here's the issue, I think. You're right that the majority of people in Iran are below the age of 30. They tend, if you look at the public opinion polls, to have a positive impression of the United States. They're not anti-American, the people, but their government is funding terrorism. Their government has lied about the nuclear program. And so I think you have to make a distinction between people and government. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not there's going to be a democratic movement that is sustained in Iran, because the government there is quite harsh. It routinely violates the human rights of the Iranian people. It jails and sometimes kills opponents of the regime inside Iran. And it's governed by a supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, who's quite conservative, rigid, anti-American. And he's supported by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Command, which is a very tough, very aggressive, very hardline conservative military force. So I think you're right to make the distinction between the government and the people. I just don't know, as an analyst who, you know, as someone who watches Iran carefully, whether the people are going to win out in this struggle for greater freedom for women, greater freedom, you know, greater grounding in human rights, or whether or not this hardline anti-American regime is going to hold sway. It's going to be interesting to watch. But I think President Obama was right not to base this nuclear deal on the hope that Iran might change, because it might not.
If this deal goes through, is there a chance that it's going to help a reform wing in the upcoming legislative elections, the 2016 February midterms there, which is, I think that's the Parliament and the Assembly of Experts are both going to be on the ballot at the same time, which is, I think, the first time that's happened.
Well, we'll see. In the last national elections, the so-called reform movement led by now President Rouhani won the election. They clearly have a different view as to how Iranian society should be structured, as to how much reform there should be, than the hardliners. And it's going to be interesting to see if sanctions are lifted because on the Iranian people because of the nuclear deal, and if the government's able to boost the economy and give people some hope that their lives are going to improve, will that help the reformers in the next elections? It's something that remains to be seen. But, you know, since the Iranian Revolution started in 1979, there have been periodic attempts by the reformers to take power, to push through reforms, and at each point they've been rebuffed by the conservatives. I would call them really reactionaries. And so I think this is going to be one of the major dramatic points of contention for the next couple of years. Are the reformers going to hold sway, or will the reactionaries?
Here in the U.S., obviously, we've got the debate happening in Congress and in the public sphere. Some of the opponents of the deal are claiming that they only want a better deal. But if this deal doesn't take effect, or if it falls apart, is there actually a diplomatic, realistic plan B here that doesn't involve military responses, or is the sanctions environment going to fall apart and everything else from there?
I don't think there is a credibly better deal out there that's practical and available to the United States. So I've testified before Congress four times this summer on the Iranian nuclear deal. I support it. I believe it's a hard deal to look at because they're both benefits and risks. But I think it's the best alternative for us. And the critics say, and many of these are in the Republican Party, but some in the Democratic Party, they say the president should walk away from this deal unilaterally, that we should maintain the sanctions on Iran and wait for a better deal. I don't think that's a practical alternative. If we just walked away, we'd be the only country walking away. Britain, France, and Germany would not walk away with us. Certainly Russia and China, these are our negotiating partners, would not walk away with us. And if we walked away, I fear three things would happen. Number one, the global isolation of Iran would begin to break down because it would be Iran staying with the agreement and we would be rejecting it. Secondly, the sanctions that had been so tough in Iran that really drove Iran to the negotiating table, they'd begin to erode. Their effectiveness would diminish. And third, all the restrictions that are currently placed on the Iranian nuclear program would be lifted. So Iran would be free to make advances on its nuclear program because the deal would dissolve because we would have walked out. When I look at that, and this is a major alternative being proposed by President Obama's critics in the Congress, that alternative that their critics are proposing, I think, would weaken the United States, strengthen Iran, and bring Iran closer to a nuclear weapon. I think it makes no sense at all.
My guest today has been Nicholas Burns, a former U.S. ambassador to Greece and NATO and the former lead U.S. negotiator on nuclear issues with Iran. He is now the Roy and Barbara Goodman Family Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador Burns, thank you for bringing your expertise on Arsenal for Democracy this week.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me now on the line, both from Massachusetts, is Nate. Hey, Nate.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
And Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hello, Bill.
Okay, let's talk about the Republican field. We should talk about, you know, some things that happened in the debate and how things are starting to shape up. The first presidential debate, there were actually two on the same day, but the big one with sort of the front runner candidates was the highest rated non-sports event in cable television history, which I think is maybe not surprising considering that one of the people on the stage was a reality TV star, and reality TV is pretty popular, and he's made this race into a reality television show. Let's start with you, Nate. Did you watch the debate or just see kind of highlight clips?
I actually forgot it was on, but I did catch the spin after the debate, so I just turned on Fox and switched around to MSNBC and CNN, see what they were thinking about who performed well and sort of what the big flashpoints were. It was interesting to see a small just group of voters being interviewed by, you know, Republican spin doctor Frank Luntz, and just seeing what their opinions on the thing were. And, you know, a lot of people, it seems like they caught on to Trump's act. You know, a lot of people were saying how it was just Trump won the debate, or just there was so much hype around him that, you know, that sort of overshadowed everything else. But a lot of these voters I talked to, they recognize that, I mean, this guy's a clown. Like, this is not a serious candidacy, and they didn't really seem all that interested by him. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how he plays out in the next couple of debates and, you know, what sort of trajectory his campaign takes, whether it'll just continue to slowly build and rise or if it falls off a cliff at some point. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I definitely want to circle back to that because I think that the longer this sort of continues, the more the Trump phenomenon becomes a really interesting thing. You know, if it goes really long, it could potentially be a pretty significant phenomenon in the course of American political history, actually. But as you said, it could also flame out. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. Kelly, I want to get your reactions. Did you see the debate or also just check out highlights?
I actually watched the whole debate with members of my family of varying political parties. So myself and the people I was watching the debate with, we found the low point to be when Megyn Kelly pointed out some of the remarks that Donald Trump had made about women over the years. And not only the remarks that Donald Trump himself made, but sort of the reaction from the crowd he got when he mentioned Rosie O'Donnell and
began insulting her. I understand some people's frustration with political correctness and sort of the constant fear that you're going to say something that might offend someone, but those remarks that Donald Trump made clearly crossed the lines of decency. And I don't, those remarks aren't okay. Not because they're not politically correct, but because I don't want a leader that thinks those things and says those things. So there is such thing as decency, and I was disappointed that there was not any standard for decency up on that stage as we were trying to, you know, select a leader for our country. We'll be selecting from that stage, but, you know.
Right. Yeah, I watched part of the debate mostly toward the end, so I missed some of the bigger flashpoints, I think, like the ones you're mentioning. I was actually watching the Canadian leaders debate for 2 hours, and so that's why I missed, like, I think at least half of the Republican debate. I have to say, you know, all those, they had the four party leaders or whatever, the three big ones and the Green Party leader on stage at the Canadian debate, and all of them, including the Conservative, who is the probably one of the most conservative prime ministers in Canadian history, they are all less conservative and more competent than anybody that was on that stage. And, you know, like you, Kelly, I'm not planning to select anyone on that stage to vote for. But if I had to, gun to my head, I don't know if I could. I mean, it was bad. It was real bad. Like, none of those people should be president for so many reasons. It was just kind of a nightmare to watch.
The one candidate that did stand out to me as interesting, if nothing else, was Governor Kasich of Ohio. He was seemed to be the wild card of the debate, even telling us that he went to a same-sex wedding. So there, he seems to be the more progressive of the bunch, the more middle of the road. But he, of course, has the reputation of sort of being a you know, strong-willed, not excited to compromise politician, which I don't believe is what we need right now in Washington. But I did enjoy hearing him speak and just, you know, seeing a little bit of variety in the Republican Party.
What did you think of the Marco Rubio comments? It was weird to me that they had an entire social issues section of the debate. I guess it's not surprising, but it still came off as very bizarre. You know, they were asking him, like, if he believed in an exception on abortion for rape or incest, and he just flatly was like, no, which, I mean, I guess points for consistency, because, like, if you oppose abortion for all the other reasons, it is a little weird to then make exceptions, even if they're very reasonable exceptions. But on the other hand, a majority of Americans, I mean, even though it's a closely contested issue in most polling as like a generic question, my understanding is that quite a large majority of Americans, like, you know, 3/4 or whatever, support exceptions like that. So that seemed like he was staking out a very aggressive, like, not at all compromising position there.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Well, obviously the social issues is always interesting to watch. I was, as they started talking about that, I was like, well, how many ways can this go wrong? But Marco Rubio, I believe, was talking about how he had, you know, signed on to proposals that included exceptions just for the sake of getting any sort of restriction or limitation back in place. But in his core, he is, you know, anti-exception. So I he was very hardline on that. He was very direct. He wasn't the only candidate on the stage with those views. But I had really thought that him and Jeb Bush would be the more serious, more moderate candidates. And that wasn't the card he was playing based on that response. So again, I think we're seeing candidates go all the way to the right during these primaries. And we'll see if they start paddling back when it comes to the general election. Another interesting thing I pointed out was that the debate pretty much ended on a question about God, which was a little bit disturbing to me, seeing as how we live you know, supposedly in a country with separation of state. Of course, we know that doesn't actually exist, but I thought it was quite flagrant of Fox News to just downright end, you know, on the God question.
Well, and not just any God question, because it was specifically asking them if they had received instructions from God to run for president, which is a reasonable question actually to ask at this point, because like people like Michelle Bachmann in the last cycle were claiming that they had a hotline to God or whatever, and you could see some of the candidates up there squirming. I mean, Scott Walker had a pretty effective answer of saying, yeah, you know, that he prayed and thought about it and it tries to live godly values, but he wasn't on the phone with God getting direct commandments to run for president or anything, which right, honestly at this point that's pure moderation to say something like that. But yeah, that
really taking the middle ground between the direct line to God or just visions of God telling him what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's something that, you know, a psychiatrist might ask you as you're getting checked in to some sort of inpatient facility. Are you hearing voices? Has God spoken to you in the last 48 hours?
Are they telling you to run for president?
Yeah. So I think that what some people in this country thought was the right answer, yes, I talked to God, wasn't really the answer I was looking for from our next president.
We should probably talk about just the total field and sort of where we think it's going to go from here.
It seems like in terms of establishment candidates, Jeb Bush is still pretty much the front runner. I don't think that's necessarily going to change anytime soon. But something that keeps on coming up for Jeb Bush and really keeps coming back to haunt him is things related to the Iraq War. Now, as we've talked about on the show previously, you know, maybe some of the Iraq War stuff should also be haunting Hillary Clinton. But I think the difference here that is not, in my opinion, being pointed out nearly often enough in media reports is that it's not just, oh, Jeb Bush is the brother of George W. Bush, right? That would be a fair, like a strong-ish connection, but not in and of itself definitive. The issue is that his foreign policy advisors are literally the same people from the George W. Bush administration. Folks like Paul Wolfowitz and any number of other names, you can look them up. They're working for the Jeb Bush campaign. They're his foreign policy advisors. These are the people who made catastrophic decisions in not just going into Iraq, but also what happened after we got there. And they seem to be trying to sort of rehabilitate their reputations via Jeb Bush. He's their vehicle back into power, not just to continue those policies, but to really double down on what already happened. One of the things that's, I think, has come up a lot is the issue of the surge. Obviously, Jeb Bush isn't the only one making this case, but basically I've talked about this so many times now on this show. The mythology around the surge is, you know, George W. Bush added a bunch of troops and then the war was won and then Obama lost it, right? That's not actually what happened. The mission of the surge, as stated by George W. Bush and his advisors when it started, was that they were going to significantly ramp up the troop presence, change some of the tactics to focus on protecting civilians, and they were going to create the political space in Baghdad for a solution, like a lasting, you know, unity deal, peace government, whatever, to be formed. And they did get the violence down significantly, although there are many factors for that, not all of which were the U.S. troops arriving. But that was only ever a temporary thing, even by the, you know, George W. Bush's own definitions. That was really intended to be temporary. It wasn't meant to be this permanent stabilization force. And the political solution side of it, which was honestly, obviously the most important part, never happened. It just simply did not happen. And a lot of the sort of resentments that built up as a result of that political failure then led to, you know, the rapid takeover of ISIS and everything that we, you know, see associated with that in Iraq. So the, you know, but the Jeb Bush people are all George W. Bush people who've been hearing that they made all these mistakes, which they did for, you know, the past 10 years or so, even longer at this point, if you're talking about beginning of the war decisions. And they're all like sitting there telling Jeb Bush, like giving him legitimately bad political advice of saying, yeah, just, you know, endorse everything that happened under George W. Bush because it was the right way to go. And again, like, you know, you could say, okay, they made an honest mistake or something like that, right? But they didn't. I mean, that's part of the problem here. In many cases, they made catastrophic errors based on, like, really stupid decision-making. Paul Wolfowitz, for example, who, as I mentioned, is specifically a major foreign policy advisor with Jeb Bush, he literally believed this conspiracy theory that some professor that he knew had, that like Saddam Hussein's intelligence services were behind all U.S. terrorist attack, like all terrorist attacks against the U.S. foreign and abroad that had happened in the 1990s all the way through, you know, 9/11 and everything. He thought 9/11 was the, you know, Saddam Hussein's intelligence service. He thought the first World Trade Center bombing was also Saddam Hussein. He thought that the Oklahoma City bombing, which was a white guy, a white right-wing guy, he thought that that was also Saddam Hussein. I mean, that was a full-blown nutso conspiracy theory. He also got mad during the Clinton administration because the CIA or something wasn't taking this theory that he had seriously. He kept writing to them and being like, why aren't you taking this seriously? And they're like, there's no evidence to support this. This is nuts. And as soon as he got into power under George W. Bush, he started, you know, pushing really hard for, you know, overthrowing Saddam Hussein. And then you get comments like Jeb Bush the other day saying that on balance, getting rid of Saddam was a good deal for the United States. No, it wasn't. There's no metric by which that's true. And yet he's still saying this. And so I it's remarkable to me because I understand that he's not going to completely distance himself from what George W. Bush did, but he's completely doubling down because these terrible people surrounding him are telling him to do that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, obviously Wolfowitz, I don't know if there are another what the other foreign policy advisors are, but these are the guys that were, you know, very much involved with Project for a New American Century in the lead up to the Iraq War and during the 90s, as you mentioned. Really, as you said, looking for Saddam Hussein under the bed or in the closet at any opportunity, trying to find out ways that they can, you know, finish the regime change that was sort of halted abruptly during the first Bush administration. So, you know, that's Saddam was always sort of their white whale there for a little while, and they finally got him. But what is concerning is what direction they'll turn to now. Obviously, there's been conflict in Syria for a while. There's been rumblings that they wanted to invade Syria, you know, like 2 years after the war in Iraq had started, not ended, obviously. So, you know, these are the sort of things that we have to keep a pretty watchful eye on because, I mean, just Wolfowitz, a lot of these other guys, they really have no compunction about sending American military power to solve relatively petty things in the Middle East. Obviously, a lot of these conflicts are not petty, but for the U.S. interests, in a lot of cases, you have to really weigh the benefits of sending in U.S. forces versus, you know, other solutions or other avenues that they could try. So, I mean, I think for a lot of people trying to claim that Jeb Bush would not be a carbon copy of the other Bush administrations or specifically his brothers, there might be some differences, but I think on core issues like national security, you're likely to see a lot of the same faces.
Another thing that was interesting to me that happened, obviously Donald Trump says a lot of crazy things and is mostly wrong when he talks about foreign policy and even specifically Iraq, for example. One wrong thing was that he thought that in order to stop ISIS, we should send special forces to capture all the oil fields in Iraq and then prevent ISIS from getting revenue from them. That doesn't make sense on any number of levels. But there was a question in Iowa that was posed to him about, or maybe he brought it up on his own, about Jeb Bush's comments with regard to Iraq. And I thought this quote was interesting. This is a Donald Trump quote giving his Iraq policy relative to Jeb Bush. He says the United States has to prove to Iraq that we have skin in the game. I think it may be one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard. Skin in the game? We don't have to prove anything. First of all, the Iraqi officials are a bunch of crooks. If there even is an Iraq, which I don't think there is, Iran is taking over Iraq. It was one of the dumbest things ever. I thought that was almost remarkably insightful, especially by Donald Trump's standards. I mean, like, it's a bit simplistic, perhaps, but arguing that the Iraqi government is crooks, check, we talked about that last week. Asking whether or not there is even an Iraq, you know, a functional, like, unified state, is it even going to stick together? Maybe not. And there probably isn't a lot of need to demonstrate you know, to prove to anyone anything in Iraq. I think we've already proven or not proven whatever needed to happen there.
That was actually not bad for Donald Trump. But again, I find that listening to the during the debate and during their sound bites to these candidates, and it's still overly simplified. And Donald Trump has announced that he's going to lay out his actual plans in September. And that's all fine and well, but I'm yet to see a candidate that seems to actually understand what's going on in the world and how things work. I thought Jeb Bush, his answers to questions about Iraq have been really awkward. Someone who's usually, you know, so well polished, this sort of gets his panties in a bunch every single time it's asked. I remember a few months ago, somebody asked George Bush about his brother running for president. And George Bush said, "My brother has one problem, and that's me." And I think that has definitely come to fruition as we see Jeb Bush, a typically polished candidate, sort of juggle his brother and, you know, maybe some of those foreign policy advisors that have his ear with what is actually happening in the world. So I think that, yeah, the Republicans seem to be tripping up on these questions about Iraq and how we're going to move forward.
One of the other things that we've been talking about on recent episodes is, of course, the money issue and sort of the role of super PACs and all of that. And I think that's going to continue to be a feature of this race. And certainly, Kelly, you and I discussed that quite in depth on a recent episode. One thing that we've seen recently is that Governor Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, his campaign is basically out of money. His staff are all working as quote-unquote volunteers. But I think that there's a very good chance that he's not going to drop out or anything close to drop out because his super PAC is going to continue to keep things alive. I think that's going to be an ongoing feature there. I referred to that on arsenalfordemocracy.com as zombie candidacies, which is based off the term from the Japanese economy of zombie corporations, where either the government or the banks or whoever just keep sort of floating bridge loans and stuff enough to keep the company going, but not necessarily to make a profit or get out of the hole that it's in, but enough to keep it from shutting down. And that just sort of goes on and on. So I think we could end up seeing something very similar there as well. But it does speak to the role that money is having in terms of, you know, once there's not really any limitation on the money in the process, you can really keep some of these candidates alive with sort of no ability to influence them to drop out. And I think Trump in particular is someone that I expect him to really go a pretty long distance, if not all the way into, you know, the general election. Whether he's the nominee or running a third party bid, just because he has a significant amount of money. I don't know that he's necessarily willing to spend as much as he's claiming he's willing to spend. Somebody asked him if he was going to spend $1 billion if it was necessary, and he was just like, yup. That, I think, is an exaggeration. I don't think he's going to spend $1 billion of his own money to do that. But I do think that there's a very strong likelihood that he's not going to be pressured to drop out by anyone. I don't think he's particularly responsible to any, you know, party leaders or whatever. Nate, you mentioned that at the beginning of the segment that you weren't quite sure where this sort of Trump thing was going. Do you predict that he's just going to flame out? Is he, you know, reached the peak of his support? Or is this, you know, potentially a phenomenon, as I suggested that it might be? Because, I it seems to me that he is tapping into a sort of unusual segment of certainly the Republican electorate, if not the overall electorate.
It's tough to say just because, you know, last election cycle, there was an interesting segment that Rachel Maddow was doing on her show talking about how she didn't really believe Trump was running for president. Of course, he had announced and briefly got into the race then, but she was talking about how this was more of a just publicity move for Trump, trying to sell his books rather than a serious, you know, grassroots political campaign. And, you know, I think there's a possibility that we're seeing something like that again. Probably will not flame out and will not just sort of fizzle out into, like, book sales and, you know, tour performances, things like that. But I don't know if this will be quite the same once we get to the primaries and, you know, the serious candidates with their field staffs and stuff will be getting organized, getting visibility. I think, obviously, Trump can hire people to do that. I just don't know if he quite has the grassroots support and just, you know, the workers and the election staff who work these long hours to, you know, get everything organized. Will that be enough for him to, you know, gain serious political ground? in some of the caucus states or just in some of the or I guess just in the primaries. But, you know, there is a possibility he will get a decent amount of votes and then that'll continue to build over the course of the primaries. He could also get, you know, in the single digits and then just sort of everyone forgets about him. And this was mostly like a Republican debate inspired media cycle where everyone's fawning all over Trump or talking about Trump. So, I mean, I don't think he's going to go all the way down to the wire, but this could be a longstanding, pretty significant part of the Republican primary where other candidates are dealing with Trump's or what he's saying or trying to piggyback on top of what he's saying or distance themselves when he says something even crazier than he's already done so. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how Trump really progresses. I don't know if he's going to be a candidate towards the end, but, you know, you never know. So it's definitely worth paying attention to this kind of oddity at this point.
Yeah, I think I wanted to ignore it at first, but then I sort of realized, oh, no, he's actually running this time. Like, he's not just immediately dropping out after a few weeks or flirting with a run and then not actually doing it. Kelly, what's your sort of take on this? Is this a strange aberration or is this a phenomenon?
You know, I tend to think that he just isn't going to go all the way, that he's fun to have around, you know, a year and a half before we vote for president, and that he, you know, definitely provides entertainment value. And he is pointing out things, obviously, that are resonating with many Americans. But I think when people have to put pencils to paper and think about the person we want representing our nation, you know, I sure hope it's not him. But I think that as long as he is in the race, which will be for quite some time, he will shape it. People will have to talk about his comments. People will have to talk about his policy ideas. People will have to decide if they're for him or against him. So I think he is going to shape this race, even though I don't think he will win it. I think one thing that Donald Trump has been talking a lot about this week is how he is self-funding his campaign and how that means he is the only politician that's not answering to anybody. And I think that just raises more really interesting questions about money in politics, because if there is no money in politics and it's just all self-funding, you know, then only the billionaire class can run for president and run for office. And that's not what we want. So he's touting his credentials as a self-funded, I don't answer to anyone kind of candidate. But no one seems to be pointing out to him that that means that there are very few people in this country eligible to run for president, and very few people who have been excellent presidents who wouldn't have been able to run had they had to self-fund their campaign. So I think there continues to be interesting questions about him and around him, and there will be for as long as he's in the race.
We are almost out of time for this segment. I think that next week we should probably talk about the feature that, if folks want to check it out ahead of time, it's on arsenalfordemocracy.com that I wrote about sort of the 1820s in American politics and sort of the party system there. I was hoping we might have time to get to it today, but we ended up having a pretty full slate today, so we can leave that for next week. But I think it's something to consider. I mean, I sort of jokingly said, is Donald Trump the Andrew Jackson of our era? That's not meant as a compliment. But, you know, because Andrew Jackson was, of course, famously a super wealthy populist slave owner who challenged people to personal fights all the time.
You know, kind of a Indian killing maniac, too.
Yeah.
From his time in the army and then as president. But
right. Not a great person, but somebody who certainly figured out how to harness a movement at a unique time in American politics. And I, you know, there were the thing that made me end up writing this was that there had been an op-ed that was in the Washington Post about the it was headlined, "Is this the four-party moment?" You know, instead of talking about three parties or whatever, you know, that there's been a few points in American history where things have, especially at the presidential level, briefly broken into four categories. Obviously, most famously, 1860, which ended up kicking off the Civil War. Not that that was the comparison being made there particularly. But they didn't really talk about the 1820s. And there was sort of a much more fundamental sea change happening there for a lot of reasons that I discussed in the essay. So I'd encourage people to check that out. That's at arsenalfordemocracy.com. And hopefully we'll be able to talk about that next week as well. I don't know if you guys had a chance to check out the essay, but so far I've been hearing pretty positive feedback on it.
Yeah, I did take a look at it before we started the show, and it's definitely interesting. I don't know if we're going to go towards four parties, but it's an interesting look at a very different time in our political history.
All right. Well, in just a moment, Kelly and I are going to be back to talk about Planned Parenthood and what's going on with that. But Nate, I'm going to let you get going. Thanks for dropping by.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. Bye, Kelly.
Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me is Kelly. We're going to talk now about Planned Parenthood and the situation that's been happening in the past several weeks. Kelly, what's the basic overview of what happened?
Yeah, so essentially there were some videos that Planned Parenthood claims was doctored, in which it sounded like Planned Parenthood was selling fetuses. What's really going on is with patients' consent, Planned Parenthood is facilitating the use of fetal tissue for scientific research. And it is very standard to sell this tissue to researchers. Nothing illegal appears to have been going on. From what I've read, however, the videos were disturbing to think of selling fetuses and that somebody's, you know, job was to negotiate prices for fetuses. Obviously, that's extremely disturbing footage and has hit a nerve with a lot of Americans who, you know, are either who don't believe that abortion should be legal or sort of on the fence and queasy about it and not that well informed about it. So this has struck a nerve and has continued to be in the spotlight over the past couple of weeks, even leading to a vote in Congress to potentially defund Planned Parenthood, and some members of Congress saying they would defund the whole government in order to defund Planned Parenthood. And that did not come to fruition. But once again, a woman's right to choose is in the spotlight. And Planned Parenthood has become synonymous with abortion in many people's minds, despite the fact that they offer valuable health services to women, everything from mammograms to regular health screenings. Most of what they do is extremely mundane, doctor's office type of work, with 3% of their visits regarding abortions. However, that is the 3% that the Republican Party has decided they want to talk about, not the 97% of time that they are providing important services to our community that are not abortion.
And so a lot of this has to do with fetal tissue, I guess, is the latest sort of thing. What is that really? You know, like what was the sort of quote unquote industry that was in question here?
Yeah, so fetal tissue is used by a lot of medical researchers. It's obviously extremely hard to do research on humans. You know, you hear about research in rats, research in whatever animal, but it's really hard to make that jump to research on humans because you want to make sure that what you're doing is valuable and safe. So one of the ways researchers do that is to, you know, study their work on fetal tissue, study the fetal tissue itself, just to give us a better idea about the human body. It's for medical research. It has been used in medical research for decades. This is not new. The New England Journal of Medicine has actually spoken out to defend Planned Parenthood and their you know, selling of fetal tissue for research. This is not a new thing that's happening. It's important for the scientific community. Actually, Dr. Ben Carson, who is running for the GOP nomination for president, himself has done research on fetal tissue. So this is not new by any means.
And one of the presidential candidates has apparently been involved with this.
Yeah, and that's Dr. Ben Carson, who, when he was asked about it, you know, sort of muddled through a response about his intent was to help people and the intent of the people to providing abortions was to
this
hurt
was
people.
Back in the 1990s, right? This yeah, was 1990s. Like Johns Hopkins, I think.
Yeah, I believe he claims that it happened in 1992. So this was, I mean, just 23 years ago. It was standard enough that he was doing this research then.
And he doesn't, he somehow seems to have, in his mind, reconciled his staunch opposition to abortion with his work on fetal tissue, but also saying that Planned Parenthood was doing something wrong. That part was kind of unclear to me. I guess it was unclear to everyone.
I mean, yeah, I think that he made a statement. I think the point is that it was an extremely muddled statement in which we're not really clear. But again, him claiming, you know, that his intent was pure and that, you know, admonishes him of any wrongdoing, but that he is, you know, totally against what Planned Parenthood is doing. So
he also, I guess I was looking at a Washington Post article. It seems like he's convinced that the tissue he was using was maybe, I don't know, miscarriages or something, like not from abortion, whereas he seems to think that Planned Parenthood is, I mean, it almost sounds like he's suggesting that they're growing fetuses and then killing them solely for the purpose of generating fetal tissue, which is obviously not true.
Yeah. He's also turned, you know, the conversation on Planned Parenthood to be one of eugenics and them deciding who can have a child and who cannot have a child, which is not true today. There have been ugly periods of sort of misuse of medical technology in our nation's history, but today Planned Parenthood really stands to serve its communities in the best way possible and just to serve the women that need their services.
Right. Now, it seems like, and I think other people have expressed this as well, this whole quote-unquote debate that has really sprung up, I don't know that it's necessarily changing a lot of minds. I'm not even sure it was intended to do that. It almost seems like it was just meant to shock people who are already opposed to abortion, you know, validate their views and help, you know, gin up money and fundraising for various anti-abortion causes and candidates. It doesn't seem like, I mean, it seems like if you, like, there probably aren't a lot of people who are supporting abortion without knowing what it was.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of sort of like conservative chest beating going on, sort of a rallying cry around this one issue that all the GOP factions, you know, have decided to stand together on. I actually have a good friend who pointed out during the debate that unborn children are the only demographic that the GOP appears to have compassion for. So they, I think it's a lot of chest beating, a lot of fundraising happening. I mean, those videos were just, incredibly edited to serve a very singular purpose. And if you're going to do your research and be against Planned Parenthood and their services, that's one thing. But that video shouldn't have changed anybody's mind, and it's a real shame if it did.
And what was the situation in Congress? I know some of the state legislatures are still considering defunding, which I don't quite know how they're supposed to remove state funding from specific organizations without that being an unconstitutional bill of attainder, meaning a bill that specifically targets one individual or entity, without also then just cutting off all state funding for women's health programs. But what was the outlook on the congressional front?
Yeah, so what Planned Parenthood is saying and has been saying for a long time, and I take them at their word for this, is that none of the money they receive from Congress is used to provide abortions. Period. Thank you. Goodbye. Now, I tend to completely agree with that because I think Fox News would have uncovered it a long time if the situation was otherwise. They're using this money to provide mammograms for people who wouldn't be able to afford it otherwise, to provide birth control, to provide all sorts of women's health services. Congress, or certain members of Congress are claiming that the, you know, money is fluid. If you're giving money to an organization providing abortions, then you are yourself providing abortions. So they tried to defund it to stop federal funding from going towards Planned Parenthood, and again, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, was a total rock star, and pointed out that these Republicans were not voting to defund abortions. They were voting to defund mammograms and to defund birth control and to defund sexual education programs for high schoolers. So, but again, like we just said, I think it was a great opportunity for, you know, conservatives to be able to say, I voted to defund Planned Parenthood. I mean, that looks good on a bumper sticker, is a good headline for them. So I think they were, you know, using the situation to their advantage.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about these issues.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8bitanimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.